As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
No pressure than hold, riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking, yeah. Can none of y'all mirror me back? Yeah, hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm young H.O., raps great for dead.
Welcome back to Miami Nice. Oh my goodness, I'm staring at a now cinematically immortalized film critic from the LA Times, my dear friend Katie Walsh.
Hello, it's true. I'm here. But I've never used the word jazzy in a review.
Never jazzy.
Only maybe about Miami Vice.
Only on this podcast are you jazzy.
Yes.
As you guys know, Miami Nice is a treat for Katie and I, and hopefully for you guys listening, because now what we do, rather than trying to put the mileage and be exhaustive on this movie, we just come back to it with people who, like us, love it. And so I wanted to talk to this person. We have a very like short list, and it only like grows incrementally every now and then by someone bullying us online to say that they must be a part of this show. But this person was on our list from the very beginning. He is an unfathomably talented film critic, which he does part-time, which is annoying because he's very, very good. So only after 11:47 p.m. on a Saturday night is he a film critic. The rest of his days are spent at a day job where he's an insurance agent. He has bylines at RogerEbert.com, Metaplex. Vague Visage is where you can find his incredible piece on this film, Movement and Melancholy in Miami Vice, that I was lucky enough to read before he even got published there. This man wrote this line: Miami Vice is a concert of image, sound, behavior, instinct, feeling, and vibe. Brendan Hodges, welcome to Miami Nice, because this is a podcast all about that vibe.
I am so happy to be here. I love Miami Vice. And in fact, on the first podcast I ever did with you, Blake, on One Heat Minute, we had, I think, like a 10-minute digression.
Yeah.
Just on how great Miami Vice is.
And if people have listened to One Heat Minute, go back. There's like, you'll find the guest list for half of the show that hasn't been on here yet of people who like stopped the One Heat Minute tracks just to talk about Miami Vice for 10 minutes. Blake, I just want to talk about Numb Encore. I think that's those people's names are Katie Walsh. Those people's names are, there are certain people who just mentioned it. And of course, like there is something about it that is like undeniably comforting. I don't know. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like, and I think you did such a, I don't think it's going to be possible short of us like literally reading your great and lengthy piece, and we'll try and touch on sort of the big key points. But I think that that's, something that we always talk about when we get together over this sort of campfire of a show is like, it is a weird and wonderful and unique thing that you can just keep going back to. And it's just so goddamn pleasurable in all of its sleaze, in all of its, you know, over the top things, in all of its incongruities, whether it's like naturalism versus like cool shit. It's great. It's awesome.
Yeah, I think, Brendan, you articulate in that piece really well, like the appeal of this movie that people are constantly talking about, which is like how rewatchable it is because it's just a vibe and it's a mood. And sometimes you don't even need to know what's happening or like who's double crossing who. You just need to kind of like go on the ride. And you really do articulate that in that piece, which is like, just sink into it, go on the mojito run and like let it blow.
Now, I want to talk about one big part because obviously there's plenty of things that you want to talk about, but I just want to kick off with like, there's one thing that you call this movie, which I think we've kind of touched on, but I wanted to sort of lead off with it, is that it is really a kind of hyper romantic, unapologetic love story. And there's like a whole part of this movie, which is just like a really, it is a relationship that is riding an asteroid that is about to crash into the earth. And there is something that is so addictive of watching like this thing that is just burning at a heat that you cannot measure, and but you know it is going to crash and burn. Like, is that, can we talk a little bit about you, Brendan, with like that appeal as an entryway into your love of Miami Vice?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the big stumbling blocks for people who don't love Miami Vice is that they just don't get the romance. I know so many people who are like, no, I get the vibe. I get the HD video. I love all that. I love the heightened dialogue. I love visuals. I love the pacing. But then the love story kind of takes over the movie and I just check out because I cannot invest in this love story. And what's so interesting about this is that for me, it's the total opposite.
This is where I check into this movie.
Well, like for me, as soon as I started watching it, within seconds with that hard cut into the club at the beginning, I say in my piece, it was like I was getting jacked into the Matrix. And it was this like amazing experience from the get-go for me. But I had no idea where it was going. And in all of Michael Mann's other movies, except for maybe Last of the Mohicans, the romance is very much a subplot. It's a B plot that interweaves with the main narrative. And I love reading Manuela Dargis's writing on Michael Mann because she so wonderfully articulates what a romantic filmmaker he is.
Yeah.
But in Miami Vice, it's like so bizarre because about halfway through the movie, it stops being this like a crime film. That becomes the B plot. And the A plot becomes this crazy love story where, sure, you could argue, well, why do they click and why is this happening? But all that really matters for me is that the camera is following these two people, their body language, their chemistry, the way they look at each other, the way they dance with each other. And, you know, I love all those dancing scenes midway through the movie. That's like one of my favorite parts of any of Michael Mann's films. Because when I watch it, it's like, I want to go dancing. I feel like I'm dancing with them. And you feel like you're part of that intoxicating experience, right? And that is, I think, what really makes or breaks the movie for people. It's so weird, just structurally, what the movie's doing, right? I can't name many other crime movies where it does that. Movies, period, that almost switch gears that hard midway. So I think that's kind of key to the movie. And I think that's why some people find the ending scenes devastating and profound and emotional or flat and boring and undynamic. It really depends on your investment in these characters. And it's like Katie was saying, you either go with them or you don't. And I certainly do.
It's so interesting that you're talking about what we expect from a crime movie, because it made me think of Julia Hart's I'm Your Woman.
Jimmy.
Something happened tonight. You'll work out with Cal where you're gonna go.
Who the hell is Cal? Where is Eddie?
I'm Cal.
Which is inspired by Thief.
Terrific movie.
And how she basically uses it as this exercise to say, okay, at this point, the woman goes this way and the man goes this way. And usually we follow the man and see what he's doing. And instead we follow the woman. And I think the film sort of like purposely obfuscates like what the crime is or what's happening or what her husband's done.
Well, who the protagonist should be.
Yeah. Right. And because she doesn't know what's going on. So it's like, we're so with her point of view that we are like, I have no idea like what her husband's done or who the guy he killed is, but it's like, doesn't matter because that's, we're just with her. But
And you get no preamble, which is so fantastic. It's like, in much like, I don't know if anyone's made the comparison, if there's anyone in the world who has, it's literally you, Katie, of like, it literally drops you media res into this person's life, and it's sad and it's lonely and it feels like it's a bit sort of listless and directionless. And then 1, 2, 3, bang, like the story happens and you're in, and it's like, wait, is anyone ever going to tell me who this guy is?
Right.
What he's done? Like, can I get something? And then you kind of go, as soon as you turn that impulse off in your brain sometimes that programmatically is there, it's like, oh no, I'm good, this is great, like, yeah, get in the car with this guy that you've never met before, I love it, let's go, like, right, and take the baby, let's go.
And we're not gonna know, you know, why this guy is picking you up until like the third act of the movie. Yeah. But you know, it's interesting because you said, Brendan, like, not a lot of crime films will do this thing where suddenly we're having this romantic weekend in Cuba and we're dancing, right, and we're in the condo and we're learning about each other. You know, I mean, I love how I'm saying we as if I'm like part, I'm like, hey guys, I'm in the thruple.
You're suddenly Gong Li. She's adopted the Gong Li.
Right.
I mean, that's just like in the corner, like, yeah, hey, can I watch you guys?
Well, I think that's exactly it, which is that for people who do connect with the movie, you feel like you're in on the love affair. And it's very somatic, you know. I took a wonderful class in college called Film and the Body, and basically the premise of the class was studying how the brain interacts with mirror neurons as we experience moving images with sound, movies. And it's so interesting the way that our body can try to mimic or like play pretend with what's happening. And the great example of that is in Die Hard, when McClane runs on the glass, you feel the glass on the bottom of your feet.
Yeah.
And very much the same thing with Miami Vice for people who love it, because you feel as though you are also dancing. And
I can feel every bit of the ice from the mojito in my mustache, every single one. I can feel everyone. I'm like, oh my God, it's sweaty. It's awesome. I want to be exact. I'm a fiend. I'm a big disco guy. I want to be right there, you know, in every one of these club scenes. It's like, especially after 2020, you see these club scenes and it's like, give me my kingdom for a club like that to go in and dance safely.
15% of this movie is us discussing how much we want to go to a club in 2020. I mean, 15% of this podcast, like, we need to do like a breakdown of how much time we're like, God, I want to go to the grimiest club I can think of. I want to go to the
most disgusting club. There is definitely a highlight reel in that.
Yeah. I mean, I can feel his sweat-soaked Guayabera shirt, you know, blasting on a go-fast boat to Havana. Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly what you're saying. It's very visceral and you can feel the humidity and the barometric pressure and all of that stuff kind of oppressing all of them, but also creating something that's super heady and tangible.
I take you to the best place for mojitos.
Where's that?
Bodeguita del Medio.
Oh, the keys?
Havana.
Havana. Cubans don't like my business. And they don't like my passport.
It's okay. The Harvard method is my cousin.
What are these
Yeah, 100%. And I would add that it's not just that they go away, it's that becomes the engine of the narrative, because the fact that they can't stop dancing is what gets everybody caught and in trouble and everything like that. So it's like, Michael,
you do that introductory line in your piece, you're like, this is one of the only crime movies that ever been derailed by dancing. Like that's yes. Like that. And it does, it completely derails the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of unthinkable to imagine in Heat, Macaulay gets caught because he dances with his new romantic interest. And then Vincent Hanna sees it and is there a way, you know what I mean? Like it's inconceivable that a quote unquote serious cerebral adult crime film will operate that way. And the movie doesn't, the thing I love about it more than maybe anything else is that it doesn't hide what it wants to be. It's not trying to smuggle its idiosyncrasies in.
Yes.
It is gloriously doing what it wants to be doing. It has no inhibitions about wearing its freak flag, so to speak, you know, the moxie of it. And I think that suits the movie. You like, I love each big swing and I love watching them fly out of the park, you know?
Yeah.
I would also say, you know, when we're talking about the dancing scene, like driving sort of the conflict of the movie, like I think another element of that is the Tubbs' hesitancy because he's worried about the woman that he's in love with. You know, Tubbs is kind of pushing back on Crockett and this romance because he's like worried about the Naomi Harris character. And you know, that is another like really emotional through line for me is like, and especially in the director's cut, there's more of that establishment of the threat that's made to her and that he's very concerned about it. And again, we've said this a million times, but like, we're like, the coffee scene needs to be in the theatrical.
There are three cuts of Ali. Actually, there might be four, but there's definitely three that I own on variety of different mediums. And so for me, it's like, there needs to be a third cut of Miami Vice, which restores that coffee scene, because that I completely agree. There's a moment in that director's cut coffee scene for anyone, if you're not like super familiar with it, where basically it is showing, it's like Ricardo finally revealing all of his heart on his sleeve about like not wanting to go as far as Sonny, and Trudy does the dutiful thing, but you kind of even know it, like it almost foreshadows even more heavily that she's going to be in trouble, which is, she's like, no, I need you to go out there and be on that edge, and you can't think about me. That's not what, I'm not like a damsel. And like, she kind of takes her agency as part of the crew. Like, I'm not your damsel. Like, you need to go as far out to the edge and not be worrying about what I'm doing, because I can look after myself. And that's where you can kind of see the shift in Rico's mindset of like, let's keep playing it up. Let's keep going up. I'll never doubt you. Let's keep going. But it's just, there's this beautiful scene that, you know, it's why some people wanted Pacino to be on coke in Heat. And I'm like, I don't need it. But I think in Miami Vice, like, I want this, because I kind of want that little bit more conflict for Rico, because he's such a great totem in this movie that you can follow and constantly get new things out of. But yeah, I would love that scene because of exactly that.
Right.
I mean, for me, that's the one scene of the director's cut that I think should be in the theatrical. Otherwise, I'm a major proponent of theatrical.
Yeah, same in only, this.
Sorry, Bill. I know that you love the director's cut. I'm sorry.
This is another thing that happens on the show. People talk directly to Bilga like it's his voicemail.
Bilga, I have a message for you. Theatrical cut is superior. I just think the theatrical, it's just the opening. Like the opening is chef's kiss.
Yeah.
As you said before, like, you were plugged into the matrix in that opening. So we don't need the whole boat race. As much as we love the boat race.
I love that scene. It's amazing. I just wish it was somewhere else in the movie.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's so interesting. I don't know. It's like, we need a third cut. I think what we're realizing is that we need a third cut.
I think what's happening here is that somewhere, someone just, if Vashi needed, this is another thing. If Vashi needed Mansky, the editorial consultant and friend of this and other One Heat Minute Productions is listening. Vashi, can you please, like, you're a professional. just drop that back in the theatrical cut and let's go. Like, right. I'm going to cut this out on Headliner just so Vashi can see this request and so that he can, yes. So he can see this request and do it. But I think that that's definitely something that just needs to happen. It needs to happen on the internet. Like, what was it, like Topher Grace who re-edited all the Star Wars prequels just for fun? Like, we need more of that. Like, just come on, yeah. Let's do it. We're talking about romance. And I think that one thing we haven't talked about so much, and you guys both talked about Manola Dargis talking about like romance, is just the romance of every physical location. Like, we talked about it with the clubs, like as a tangible space, but like, Nicholas's apartment is one of the most romantic places you've ever seen. Like, it's like,
is it?
Like it's, but I mean, as like it's obviously this big decadent, like completely over the top place, but it's like every place that they are like, and they're hiding in plain sight. They're staying at this huge, you know, waterfront mansion that has a boat ramp that comes out to the house. That's where they're staying to hide, in inverted commas. Nicholas's mansion looks out at the ocean. It's like this big spire. And even though you don't want to look at all this white marble and Eddie Marsden in his little, you know, leisure suit, I guess you could probably call
it's like
it.
Linen
leisure suit. But you've got these moments of like this turbulent storm going and then Sunny sort of staring out and looking at it. And I think that like, that's something to be said of like man casting the locations and scouting the locations. Like everything has this, I don't know, this mystique in almost every location in this movie. And definitely in something like Heat, you know, that one of the big capital R romantic moments is like that you, and Manola Dargis says it, you believe that Amy Brenneman as a graphic designer would own that apartment because that's like the one thing that is completely unrealistic in the movie. There is no way she could afford the apartment that she has with like the best view of LA ever. So yeah, I just want to talk to you, Brandon, because I know you mentioned it, you know, you talk about some spaces and how the comparison with Man and some other stuff is that this movie is just so incredibly full of life.
Yeah. And I think that what Man does really, really well in general is that his movies always center very human, very relatable characters amidst these abstract kind of expressionistic backdrops, yes, that are all kind of visual metaphors for how the characters are feeling. And to those of you who love Black Hat, that's also a movie that constantly centers characters in almost like these art installation spaces. Like one of the big shootouts in that movie is basically like this, there's like these cubes everywhere and I don't know why, but they're cool. And there's this general attitude to his work of space and geometry and nature and seeing how these things interrelate. I think Mann is doing very different things than a filmmaker like Antonioni, but I think one thing from Antonioni he might have learned is just how to frame characters in space.
Yeah.
And
this is his most Red Desert movie. Because yeah, like, you know,
no,
like
it is.
Where people who you feel are like real are walking through this landscape, and that almost has a surreal quality just because of how incongruous they feel. Like huge, like
yeah,
billowing factories and just someone like a drab suit and like it looks like it's in a wasteland and a bog. And yeah, there's lots of great stuff.
Yes. And I mean, Mann, I think in the director's commentary, you know, says that he wanted the environment to be like an opiate,
yeah,
in Miami, yeah, Vice. And you feel that. And in this, the case of this particular movie, I think what's a little bit different than his other films is he turns down the dial on narrative and he turns up the dial on the environment, right? And you mentioned that scene where Crockett's looking over that great vista. I mean, you don't get more of a Michael Mann image than a big epic sky, you know, endless horizons, negative space with the character framed kind of low in the overall composition. But what I think is so interesting about that scene in particular is that it's an exposition dump. And Crockett is like, I'm out. It's almost like signaling to the viewer, this narrative stuff, maybe not so important. He literally walks out of the mission briefing scene.
I love that.
Call Columbia. Man, that's Jose Yero.
Really?
He is AUC, you know? Colombian right-wing paramilitaries. You know who they are? They are vertically integrated.
You mean they walk around with constant erections?
No. They farm, process, produce, export.
I know what it means.
No, see, it gives them attitude. A player negotiates too hard and you never hear from him again because these guys kill everything. I gotta know what's the skinny.
It's none of your fucking business.
It can come back on me, baby. It
can't come back on you, baby.
I'm not sure of that.
Hey, Sunshine, when has Rico or Sonny ever lied to you? Huh? I mean, when has anything Rico told you not to happen exactly like he said?
It would be like Ethan Hunt getting the mission on the tape and just stopping listening halfway through.
Yeah, he just go, and it's not like he takes an important call or anything. He just looks out the window and looks pensive, you know. Yeah. And I think that is kind of the thing. And you don't get much more dramatic than opening a movie, not just with this gritty HD video, not just with these big video walls of flashing screens, but also these crazy, like the sky looks, I mean, there's a hurricane going on in the background, but it almost looks alien.
Yes.
You know, I watched Color Out of Space last year, which has all these like purple Lovecraftian clouds. These clouds look even more so, you know? it has this alien quality to the whole movie. And I think what that does is that it immediately makes the movie feel like more of a tapestry of image and feel than anything else. I'm going to make a weird comparison, and Blake, don't kill me because I know you don't support the Star Wars prequels as much as I do. But
if anyone's going to say I would rather watch the Star Wars prequels than the sequels. Than the J.J. Abrams sequels. right. Because the discourse is just more consistent. It's like...
Okay, that's
it's
fair.
Just like, if I say I watch the Star Wars prequels, I know what... And if I ever mention it publicly, I know what dialogue I'm going to get. If I say I'm watching The Last Jedi, I also know, and you know very well, my friend, what dialogue we're going to get. So let's talk about the prequels. Stretch it there.
So I'm a hardcore apologist of all the Star Wars prequels, and I have to go to this place. I didn't have room in my article to do this because I thought any editor would be like, nope.
this is the deleted scenes of your article, this podcast.
This is
Give us all the weird comparisons.
Give us all the weird stuff, yes.
So I grew up loving the prequels. And if you actually think about it, the prequels are movies that are also very narratively flimsy and abstract in a weird way. And they very much center image and sound. None of the other Star Wars movies literally just have endless montages of cool looking stuff with John Williams music playing.
Yes.
And
none more so than The Phantom Menace. The whole movie is just this experiential thing just flooding at you. John Williams 100%. Going absolutely apeshit, and you're like, yes, gimme.
Like the landing sequence or a bunch of the later scenes on Naboo, stuff like that. And I bring up the prequels because those movies, if you return to them, weirdly, they're similar to Miami Vice. I know that. Hold on.
This has never been a connection that's been made on this show yet. I'm excited to see where it goes.
But all I really mean is that it's very much a movie for me about vibe and feel. Hmm. And it's very much about these images and these sounds and these textures. And when people have asked me, how do you like the prequels? There's this issue, there's literally, it's like pie. You don't run out of criticisms of the prequels. There's so many of them. However, what I tell people is they're rich in thematic imagery. The cities, the designs, it's almost like walking through a contemporary art museum. Or in a way, it's almost like walking through the classical section and then going to the contemporary art section. where you kind of go between these very different types of aesthetics and what they mean and all the iconography and baggage those things bring with them. And I've always wondered, is my general preference in cinema, it's like nature versus nurture. Is my general preference in cinema for movies that feel more abstract and have like a cool vibe and operate on this level of experience?
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Is that because I grew up on the prequels? Or do I like the prequels because that's just my natural preference?
We will never know. We'll never know that. I don't know. You need to do some deep diving on that one.
That chicken and the egg question is something that this show never is going to answer. But,
but it's an interesting question for sure. Like, yeah, it's and I think what's interesting also is like when we talk about Miami Vice and the environment and the vibe, it's like I feel like Michael Mann, it's like a bucking bronco. There's a hurricane, you know. I'm from, you know, the Caribbean. So like I understand like the weather changes at any moment. Like it could rain, it could be hot, it could do this. It's like he's just like, okay, I'm just capturing the essence of this place. Whereas the prequels are, that is all created, you know, like that, right. You know, like Michael Mann's location scouting these, you know, mansions in Cuba and in Miami, but like someone else is creating it. So it's just, it's sort of this like organic versus inorganic type of,
yeah,
essence and vibe. Like, are you capturing it or are you creating it?
Well, Michael Mann, Katie, I think we've talked about like a guy is so controlled.
So like the fact
that he's controlled and the environment and everything that's going on and the, as we've heard from some of our guests and we'll hear in more detail in later shows, which we're so looking forward to doing, don't worry, we haven't forgotten about them. The behind the scenes stories of how this movie was made and all of the chaos. God. Like he is literally, I love that analogy of a bucking bronco because he's like holding on and the movie feels like you are those reins that maybe are going to break or you're going to.
At any minute.
Right. Whereas George Lucas has the inverse, his brain is like, this is every idea I've had for 40 years.
Right.
And it's just going. And you're like, holy, you're the one who's got the reins. Like,
yes.
Can I carry any of this? Whereas Lucas is like, here's every idea. Here's every thematic concept. Here's every like great visual that I've wanted to throw at you that I could never have done in every other thing. And so it's so great. And I just want to talk about just one tiny technicality, Brennan, is like in Brennan's piece, obviously having really fastidiously researched Miami Vice, he talks about the Thompson Viper camera. And just to talk about the Viper in 2006, just to talk about its application, there was another movie in 2006-07 that used the Viper to basically replicate 35mm film. And that movie is Zodiac. So talking about the versatility of HD, you only have to put the Thompson Viper, which was used, like one of the first films that was used on was this, Miami Vice, to shoot. You see like how crazy you can ratchet the colors and how crazy you can look at the nights and how insane it just like takes in all these like weird spectrums of things that you've never seen before. And then when you, you know, have it locked off in like Fincher's, this camera cannot bump 1 second, otherwise I'm going back and doing the take again version of this. Right. That's the versatility of HD. It's kind of like one of those things. We haven't really talked about it, and because we haven't really had the necessity to yet, but I think it's just one of those interesting things about the whole style of this movie. It's like, oh, it's all HD, it's visual, it's crap. And it's like, well, like two completely different films with two completely different vibes just show you the versatility and the allure of like digital. Because I can create 35 mil or I can create this new thing, which Miami Vice is.
Yeah. And so I actually think that it's weird we don't credit Miami Vice this way, and I could be wrong, but I think Miami Vice is technically the first Hollywood blockbuster shot totally digitally, or first major studio film. I think it is. I think
Collateral's earlier.
No, that's the only. I mean, all the way through.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's completely. Yeah, because Collateral's got some film.
All the way through. Collateral had like mostly 35 millimeter. I think only 40% of that movie was shot on HD. Yeah. And so you could say, oh, well, Brendan, obviously the Star Wars prequels. Ah, but the Star Wars prequels are indie movies.
Right.
So I think that. I don't mean to keep making the George Lucas Michael Mann comparison, but it's interesting because they're both pioneers of early digital as well, and the digital pipeline in general.
And they often have a lot of fans that say, God, your early movies were great. And just ignore everything they did afterwards.
Right.
They're like, I don't care about Red Tails, George, but give me American Graffiti every day of the week. You know, like that's a similarity for both of them.
Yeah, you're not wrong. But what's interesting about early digital is you have filmmakers who double down on this hyper digital aesthetic that many people would call ugly. I don't. I think it's glorious and beautiful. And I think the images in Miami Vice are some of my favorite I've seen. And this even goes for like Black Hat. Some of the images in that film are just outstanding. And then you have filmmakers who are trying to recreate the aesthetic of cinema. And what's interesting is I think they almost always have failed. Zodiac, if it's trying to look like celluloid, it doesn't. No. It looks amazing, but that's a movie that I think looks ugly in some areas as well because of the limitations of early digital. There's blown out whites a lot of the time in Zodiac. There's a very icky quality to some of the blacks in that film as well. The darks in the film are very, very much milky at times. It looks beautiful. And I think it's more importantly, it suits its subject.
But, the whole, I found this in a canister in 19, it was in a canister labeled Zodiac in 1974. And then I played it in 2008 when it was, 2007-8 when it was released.
But what's interesting is I think Zodiac, as much as the intention is to appropriate some of this celluloid tradition, not totally, obviously he shot it digitally in the first place, partly because he wanted to get those night scenes, very much like in Collateral and so forth. But insofar as it is trying to replicate celluloid, it's interesting because, it's a situation where it looks like a somewhat failed attempt at something that will get better later.
Yeah.
And the earlier digital movies, and I'm thinking even going back to like Dogma 95, those like, Celebration, like Vinterberg, that movie very much is like, this is disgustingly digital. It's grainy and noisy and everything's blown out. But it almost adopts this like gothic, spooky, spectral quality somehow.
And it fits the subject matter of sort of this like familial chaos and secrets. And it's supposed to be ugly because the content is ugly.
Absolutely. It's a perfect example of form and content being unified. And I think that was what Mann was more interested in. And you see that taken even further extremes, I think, in Public Enemies. But in the case of Miami Vice, I don't think this movie could work at all without the digital cameras because they de-theatricalize the experience. Yeah. The sets look like sets, the costumes look like costumes, and the shootouts in particular look a little hokey for some people. I think of that early shootout in the movie when the camera is placed inside of a car, when there's that drug deal gone wrong and the crazy Nazis blow those cars to smithereens and the car and the camera's locked inside. It looks like, you know, unedited, you know, film student footage in a weird way. It has a very de-theatricalized look.
Hey, Ivan, my brother. How long have you been working with the FBI?
And for some people, they check out. And this came up a lot with The Hobbit. When
the frame rates were such a crazy, that was so jarring.
Exactly. The 48 frames per second with The Hobbit movies, people were like, oh, this looks like a set. It looks like behind the scenes. But I think the difference in the case of Miami Vice is that Mann took those elements and made an entire unified look and aesthetic with them.
Yes.
So that you feel there.
Yeah.
You feel like you are in those spaces. And it is unbelievably immersive for me.
Yeah. And it almost feels like he's embracing sort of the like sleazy ad hoc, like, yeah. Oh, someone maybe captured this on a crappy digital camera, this crazy shootout. I mean, obviously it's not a found footage thing, but it, right. If it gives it that look, it gives it that kind of like rough around the edges, like maybe not perfectly celluloid captured. And you're like, oh, it feels grittier. It feels maybe a little bit more real.
Yeah.
For that time.
Yeah. Just now that, like, I think about that car scene where those huge bullets go through the car and it does like an impossible, well, a non-digital impossible shot of mounting a what feels like a surveillance camera from inside the back perch of like the top of a car. And you can't fit a camera there unless you chop the whole top of the car off, which changes the whole lighting of the scene. And it's that virtual version of that where you are looking at from, well, I'm surveilling this. And there are definitely scenes that are like that, which for a movie that does feel like it has a lure and it's pulling you through every scene, like that scene is so perfect because you're like that works. And then and later in the movie, the interplay between grainy surveillance footage and people watching people watch surveillance footage and things like that, there's a great, you know, Niall Schwartz has a great book on Public Enemies. He's been a friend and a guest of the show, and he talks about just that interplay of digital and like how screens and TVs communicate with each other in the later Michael Mann digital films, particularly in like Enemies and then, you know, in Miami Vice and stuff like that. And there's just that's one thing I love in this movie is it that thematically consistent use of this stuff, because it feels like it works. And I think that's probably the best examples, right? When it comes off because the whole thing feels like that it's intentional. Like I want it to look like this. I want to feel like this. And, you know, we've credited Michael Mann's commentary track on this show as well. One of the great ones is how he actually doesn't talk about the amazing sex that Jamie Foxx and Trudy are having in that moment. He just talks about something else completely. It's my favorite part of the whole commentary track where like they're having this amazing sex and he just doesn't mention how great the sex looks or is. He just like talks about some technical thing. It's beautiful. But I think in that moment he keeps talking about, you know, I wanted to see the night skies. I wanted to have this very visceral look. Like I want it, you know, the inside of that car, that person who's in the car getting shot up is fake. Like that's like people were kind of shocked. Like, oh, did you use a dummy? How did you do that? And it's like, no, we shot the car up and then digitally created a person in there to show them what the carnage would really look like. So it's perfect form and content marriage.
Yeah. And I would add one quick point, which is Michael Mann's whole filmography is this tension between the literal and the abstract, right?
Yes.
Between a kind of realism and a kind of fantasy. And I think that divide is never shown better than in Miami Vice, because what's physically happening is not too fantastic necessarily, you know, in the sense that it's, you know, over the top. There's no crazy, crazy shootouts. They're all done with typical Michael Mann, you know, realism or whatever. But visually, the camera makes everything seem so real,
yeah,
that it almost looks unreal. And I think that quality of being both almost a documentary style fly on the wall and having these dreamy images, it's somehow both at once. And I think that hallucinatory quality is the whole thing. I think that's really the engine of the movie, really.
And what's so funny is right at the beginning of the movie, especially in the theatrical cut, when you see Justin Theroux's character looking at the terrible like Nokia video footage of like looking at Herc with the prostitutes as they're trying to, you know, trying to do this sting operation. Obviously it's Dominic Lombardozzi, guys, but I can call him Herc right now because that's what, yes, that's what we all call him. But I think it's such a funny thing also of like, here's some terrible grainy surveillance footage, because like this is the state of the art at the moment. And then the movie has this quality like detached. It's kind of like, this is bad quality, this is good quality. Like it does this, like it's this it's intratext commentary on like, this is like state of the art and this is state of the art at the same time. It's this weird, beautiful mashup.
Right.
And also, sorry, Katie, just one second.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Last of the Mohicans is another one that not many people reference about reality and fantasy, because for all of the research that Michael Mann did and does on all of his films of like, look at these amazing costumes, look at this, you know, look at this incredible weaponry, look at this dialect, look at this incredible stuff that we've done. And then everyone's like, but how are Hawkeye and Korra's hair and teeth so perfect? Because that could not be correct in 1757. It just couldn't be correct. And everyone's just fine with everyone's teeth in the movie because it's ultimately a fantasy.
They're like, here's this replica arrowhead and also my Pantene hair.
And this glorious hair that is like impossible. It's impossible at that time.
Yes. No, I was just going to, you know, commenting on the digital nature of it all, like, and what Brendan was saying about the abstract and the realism. It's like, man, obviously, like he's adopting a new format in digital and he's obviously very excited about pushing its limits and seeing what it can do, but also letting it be its own thing and speak to the story in its own way without trying to make it be something else.
Yes.
And I love that you said it's like this hyper real thing, because I was thinking of one of the sequences at the end where they go and rescue Trudy. It almost feels like a Cops episode or something like that. And you kind of want that like not quite perfect digital aspect of like, oh, they're like rushing into the house and then they're confused. It's like all kind of at eye level.
Hold it! Hold it! Drop the detonator. Drop the detonator.
But then you might have like a scene where he's flying the plane and it's like gorgeous, big, you know, clouds in the sky. And it's like, you will take a moment to kind of just like be like, wow, look at that amazing image. And then also you can look at the amazing images of like grimy police work, you know, where they're rescuing her from the trailer. So yeah, I just love that with the way you articulated that, Brendan, in terms of like the real and the unreal and how it connects thematically as well.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah, it's They're so great. And there's one thing, Brendan, which and tags onto both something you guys both just said, which is there's a great shot that I recently heard talked about on a great show, friends of this our show, the Screen Drafts guys, and potentially a future guest on this Miami Nice show, Ben David Grabinski, was talking about a shot in Top Gun where there's a briefing for all of the soon-to-be potential Top Gun pilots. Like, it's a quintessential Tony Scott shot where rather than it being in a shitty classroom on a naval base, he's like, no, let's get flags and put like fighter jets and make it in a hangar. And that's where we're going to shoot this dumb classroom scene, because it's like, no, we're not going to, this is cinema. We're going to make the most of this epic canvas that we've got. Like, we've got full cooperation from the Army. And it just reminded me of this movie of like this, the technology. That's what I love, the versatility of digital photography. Just for me, it's because like one moment you get the, when you said the plane, I thought of the boat too, like these incredible shots that are almost unfathomable in 2006 to get. And they now have kind of formed the language of how you tell these stories all the way until now. But then there's that great scene where they're prepping to go and have this like final gun battle, and it's in an airplane hangar. And in watching just like sort of clips of this movie for the preparations for this talk, I was just like, fuck, that's such a Tony Scott like move. It's like, this could be in a police briefing room. It could be in standing at the back of a trunk, like you've seen in so many movies where, you know, like Bad Boys, where they put on the vests and they grab a shotgun and they're having a conversation, and so many other parts of this movie like that. But no, it's in this gorgeous hangar at sunset with their cool ass plane and these impossibly long tables that look like they're like for a wedding, and they're having this like cool conversation. They look immaculate and you're like, yeah, this is what we need. This is movies. This is cinema.
It reminds me just how much of a classicist man is formally, you know. Yes. It's in his bones. It's in his DNA that he has this kind of classicism to his style. And when you're saying that, it reminds me of Kurosawa and it reminds me of Ford.
Yeah.
You know, Ford would stage these banal, you know, how do we wrangle the cattle scenes with these unbelievable skies? You know, he could have done them anywhere, framed them however he wanted. It also reminded me of the police briefing scene in like my top three Kurosawa, which is High and Low.
Yeah.
If anybody hasn't seen High and Low, gosh, right, you have to find that film. Right. It starts out as a one place heist film in a way, and then it becomes this amazing noir. And there's this great police briefing scene in that movie where it goes on a long time. It doesn't end. So Kurosawa probably says to himself, how could I make this visually exciting for the viewer? So he has all these neon signs and lights out of the background, always flashing. So it's almost hypnotic. There's like this rhythm to these flashing lights. And I think that it's in that tradition of, hey, if we're going to make a movie, let's make a fucking movie. You know? Let's dress it up. You know, who cares if this scene would take place not in an amazing hangar? It's a movie, you know? And I love that.
Well, I think we've talked about the airplane hangar scene before, because I think we were like trying to puzzle out like how they get from point A to point B, and there's an airplane hangar and there's somewhere, and we're like, wait, why are they at the airplane hangar? So that's just what I was
And it was only another Miami Vice fan that made me realize, oh yeah, it's a fucking movie, Blake. Who gives a shit? Because
it looks cool.
It looks cool. That's the answer. I will
just throw my two cents in for let's make a fucking movie, which is, I felt that way about Joel Schumacher. Mm. Stay with me.
Yeah, I'm with you.
one of my favorite first watches of 2020 was Flatliners.
Today's a good day to die.
Flatline.
30 seconds to go.
Can you recall any specific emotion or sensation?
No, but there's something out there.
We're running out of time.
300, clear.
Nothing.
Your heart, go again, clear.
Nothing, I can't hear anything.
Come on, Nelson.
Breathe.
We lost him.
No!
Welcome back, man.
Because it's like, okay, we're going to like kill each other and then bring each other back to life. And it's like, okay, we're in a fucking basilica with these giant heads and flapping plastic and like smoke billowing everywhere. And it's like, why are they doing this in like an abandoned museum? Like, I don't know why, but I'm just going to go with it. And yeah. like every scene is just like smoke, neon, Kevin Bacon climbing out a window for no apparent reason. Like if you would read the script, it'd be, just be like, they talk to each other, but like all this crazy shit is happening because it can, and why not do it? So I'm all right. for make a fucking movie.
100%. This, our conversation has kind of come full circle here, because before we were talking about how man is so skillful at making the environment this thematic, you know, tapestry or stage for the characters to perform and feel in. And I think that in the case of Vice in particular, you know, he embellishes more than he has anywhere else. But to go back to this idea of like Lucas creating and man documenting or observing.
Yes.
Part of that, what makes Miami Vice so amazing, and I'm far from the first person to say this, it's a movie that feels dangerous because you almost feel as though the characters could get blown off a rooftop or lightning could come down. And it adds to this quality of like, how is this real? Like, it's a lightning in a bottle thing where a lot of what, it's like, you know, the stars perfectly aligned that man had this particular video format at this particular shoot for this particular film that happened to be shot during a hurricane.
Right.
They didn't totally plan for, and only those digital cameras could have captured, oh, not just those digital cameras shot with the ISO cranked all the way up. Fincher yeah. would never have wanted that shit. No. He would have dialed that all down and got a control-based image. But only those particular cameras in this particular shoot with the ISO cranked up with this particular style could have captured all the crazy shit that's happening in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So it's like this perfect thing where the stars are aligning in a way that filmmakers can't totally plan for or control, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they capture Colin Farrell at his most drunk Farrell,
like
sunburned, bloated.
Sunburned, bloated, and vacant in the eyes, but somehow like completely there. You're like, right. I don't understand it. I don't understand.
I mean, he's part of this like lightning in a bottle thing where it's like, we just got him and it's like he's about to go off the rails. He's about to go to Argentina and smooch Diego Maradona, but we got him for this and we captured it. And now he's like clean and doing jogging and he's totally
he's never going to do this. He's never going to do a movie like this again, unless we are worried that he's going to be derailed. But like Michael Mann, one of his first movies was like he did a documentary short called Insurrection. And I just like, it's just because I've been such a Michael Mann guy forever. You know, you see these things and you get to look at it. And it's like that was interviews with the 1968 riot leaders from Paris, like about what happened. And so like the chaotic things and chaotic times in his movies, like have an appeal. And like the chaos of this movie, you know, just seems like the overwhelming like manifestation of like, oh, you really, do you like chaotic times? Do you like chaos? Like here's the thing you probably weren't expecting was going to be chaos. And we're going to throw every curveball at you conceivable. But yeah, no, it's so good. It's so good to be back talking Miami Vice, because it's so fun to talk about with every new person.
I know.
It's so fun. And
Brendan,
fun.
You're like making me love this movie even more. Like the way you talk about it, the way you write about it, I'm like, oh my God, this is like pure cinema.
It is pure cinema. I mean, it's really a visual symphony, you know, in a way. And I totally get why it doesn't work for some people. I get it. It's not going to open every door to every viewer.
Listen, if the three of us walk to the front row of a symphony performance, and we're all in like tails and Katie's in a beautiful gown, Brendan and I have shaved our face to be more like Colin Farrell, and we sit down in our tops and tails right at the front, and instead of a symphony playing, Numb Encore plays, would we be happy?
Yes. I would scream.
I would scream. Stand up, start clapping. Like that is the difference. It's like you are there in this, you're there waiting for one thing and the movie just immediately punches you with something else. And you're like, no, I'm in. Like whatever that is, I'm in for this ride. I love it.
And I love whether we have a podcast specifically about it or whether other conversations we've had, Brendan, have derailed into it. I love talking every second to you about Miami Vice.
It's been a treat.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.